I'd like to, it's my great pleasure actually, to introduce Dr. Bec Strating. She's a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at La Trobe University. And she's a bit of a rock star doctor, as far as I'm concerned. We were lucky enough to be on a trip last year to the Republic of Korea and for a week, and I think we were the best-dressed group ever. And one of the reasons we were the best-dressed group was the previous group, someone had gone to the demilitarised zone with a shirt on that sort of said, I love beer or something like that. So we were particularly well-dressed, and we are tonight. I think I had this suit at the time. But Bec and I learned a lot about our group and each other, and some of Bec's likes include shoju, as I'm... which is a terrific Korean liqueur. Anyway, but that's just in passing, so that's part of the great pleasure. But she's also Asian Studies Visiting Fellow at the East-West Centre in Washington, D.C., non-resident fellow at Georgetown University and here at our Perth US Asia Centre as well. And she makes lots of contributions to the discussion of international relations here in Australia. I'm particularly... really impressed, but she won the Boyer Prize for the best article in the prestigious Australian Journal of International Affairs, which is our flagship journal, for her article on the Timor Sea maritime dispute in 2017, and that's a terrific accolade. So well done. Well done, Bec. So that's the quality of the speaker we have, so I'd like to introduce Bec Strating. Thank you. Cheers.
Well, thank you, John, for the very kind introduction, and thank you to the Australian Institute of International Affairs here at Western Australia and Dr. Boyd for the invitation. It's always a delight to come to Western Australia, and particularly to this beautiful campus. I was delighted to spend the morning walking around the gardens, and you're just very lucky to have such a stunning, gorgeous campus and such great people. It's so great to see old friends in the crowd today, and hopefully some new friends. Oh, yes, and St. Catherine's on the park, which is actually, the accommodation is stunning. And last night they were having their valedictory party, so I thought, oh, this is going to go all night. But they very responsibly cut it off at 11 p.m. But I was interested in the choices of music, and I was saying before that it could have been the 1970s at some point. They had, you know, Dexy's Midnight Runners, and they had the Macarena going, I think, at one stage. But anyway, lovely accommodation, and it's just really great to be here. I recently just got back from Australia. As John mentioned, I was an Asian Studies Visiting Fellow at the East-West Centre in Washington, D.C., and I've been conducting some research on maritime order and focusing in particular on the South China Sea. So I'm kind of in the middle of this ongoing research project and really focusing on regional non-claimant states and their approaches to the South China Sea. So I'm thinking about the United States, but really I'm interested in the lesser kind of regional powers, Australia, Japan, India and South Korea in particular, and how they approach the South China Sea and what kind of policies they adopt. So that's one element of what I'm looking at, a kind of comparative research project. But I'm also interested in what their responses to the South China Sea tell us about how they envisage maritime order and how maritime order might be constructed and maintained and defended with a particular emphasis on rules, right? We have these rules that try to govern these spaces, these sea spaces. How are these states trying to kind of make sure that they are maintained? How do they interpret some of these rules? And what does this mean for the political order in the Indo-Pacific more generally? So that's the kind of second aspect. And the third aspect to my research is trying to figure out how these states, how their conception of maritime order and the rules is really shaped by much broader strategic concerns about great power competition, between the United States and China and about the transforming political landscape more generally. So they're the sort of three big things that I'm interested in looking at, in particular in relation to the South China Sea. Now, I'm going to provide a bit of context for this study because we hear a lot about the South China Sea. It is a high-profile dispute. It gets a lot of attention in the media, but there's also a lot of confusion, I think, about some of the dimensions involved within this particular dispute. There are complex and convoluted layers to the dispute, which I think is helpfully illustrated by this very confusing map from the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative. And for those of you who are interested in learning more about these sorts of disputes, the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative is a fantastic resource. It has lots of maps. It's got all of these kind of interactive features where you can, you can look at particular states and their claims, and you can also, there's maps around, you know, how China is projecting power out of the South China Sea, all sorts of really interesting stuff. But I think the map really gets to the point that a lot of different states have claims, and there are a number of different claims that they're making. So the various aspects of the dispute, the sort of the first one at the heart of this is sovereignty. So these are concerns around territorial ownership. Who owns land features? Now, these are particularly pertinent in the Spratly and Paracel chains. Sort of archipelagic chains. So that's the first aspect. There are particular forms of rules in international law that try to work out who gets to own bits of land. And these bits of land happen to exist within this vast maritime space. Now, the second issue is whether these land features are islands, whether they're rocks, whether they're low-lying elevations, because these classifications of what these land features are really important because they then determine what states are able to claim in terms of maritime entitlements. So if it is an island, a state, if that's what this piece of land is classified as, then a state may be able to also claim a 12 nautical mile territorial sea plus a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone and plus, you know, maybe even continental shelf. But if it's a rock under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, if it's a rock, you only get a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. And that means that you don't get the access to the fishing resources that come with an EEZ. It means that you don't get the entitlements to oil and gas resources that come with a continental shelf claim. And this is one of the really important kind of features of the disputes, is these arguments over what these land features actually are. If it's not an island and it's not a rock under international law, it gets nothing. So these arguments are really important. And I'm going to get back to the 2016 Arbitral Tribunal ruling, which actually made a decision about what these land features are. I'll get back to that in a minute. But that's the second dimension to these multifaceted disputes. So the third relates to the exclusive economic zone and continental shelf claims of China and the Southeast Asian states and Taiwan that have these claims within the South China Sea. So you've got six states that claim not just, you know, some or all of these land features, but also have these claims extending out from their coastlines around their EEZ and their continental shelf. So this is why we get this really convoluted, complex map, because there's a lot of complicated, complex geography that is holed up in this particular area. So the EEZ continental shelf claims are particularly important for the ways that smaller powers in Southeast Asia can access their rights. But one of the challenges that is being faced by these states is a number of kind of ambit legal claims that are currently being made by the People's Republic of China. So the assertion of what we call excessive maritime claims under international law. Now, one example of this is the 9-dash line, which I think we can just make out on the map here. I'm sure that you're familiar with the 9-dash line, which China sees as being, positioning the South China Sea as part of its territory. And its historic rights doctrine that it has used to try to defend its claim to fishing and oil and gas entitlements within that region. It's not one that accords with the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, but it is a kind of alternative interpretation of law that China is putting forward. So this really affects the entitlements to jurisdiction and to resources. So then we have a kind of fourth level. We've got all these new islands popping up. So this adds another layer of confusion because there is a process by which not just China but other states in Southeast Asia are building up artificial islands. Now, under UNCLOS, these artificial islands are not recognised as islands for the purpose of determining maritime jurisdiction entitlements. But nonetheless, these artificial islands have become important for considering militarization because they have become the base for military installations and things like radars that has changed the strategic balance of power and strategic calculations in the South China Sea. And I'll get back to that in a little bit. But you've got these artificial islands coming up. Then the fifth kind of issue we've got going on here is freedom of navigation. So this is the one that the United States is really concerned about. You know, when I was in Washington, I would say, what is the United States, what do they care about this issue? You know, it's not really near the United States. The United States doesn't claim any land features in the South China Sea. It doesn't claim an EEZ or continental shelf. But for a number of people that I spoke to, freedom of navigation is a core concern for the United States. And states interpret freedom of navigation quite differently. There are two sort of key areas of freedom of navigation that states are concerned about. The first is a military conception, so what warships can do and where they can do these activities. Some states would say that the US Navy cannot transit in an expeditious way through a territorial sea without prior notification. Or for China, it would be without prior authorization. And it's not just China that has that view, as I'll get to later. But this is, for the United States, it has that right. That right is embedded in UNCLOS, and Australia would support the United States on that claim as well. And so what the United States is concerned about is whether or not there's going to be restrictions on its the capacity of its naval forces to move in the areas that the United States sees that it has a right to move in. There's also the commercial aspect. That's the one that Australia is particularly concerned about. What happens if China gets strategic control of this area and decides to blockade trade or blockade fuel, which is actually a significant security issue for Australia because we're running very low on fuel reserves in this country and we get a lot of our fuel from Northeast Asian countries. So, you know, these are the sorts of the freedom of navigation. You can unpack it. There's a lot of different parts just to this concept of freedom of navigation as well. And then the sixth dimension that I haven't got on the slide but I think is really one that is getting a lot of attention, particularly in DC, and this is the use of what is called grey zone operations. These are operations that are tactics short of war. The use of hybrid warfare strategies, the use of non-military assets to harass or to intimidate or to assert some strategic rights. So there's a whole new body of literature that has come out about these tactics that are being employed within this sphere, and how states might be able to counter some of these tactics. So there are essentially, I mean, this is the way that I kind of see it. There are two orders here at play. The first is a territorial order. It's really about who owns the land. And there are sets of rules about that in international law. They can involve history. They can involve effective occupation. They can involve nationalism, all of that discovery. All of this stuff that we hear about the history of the South China Sea is really wrapped up in this: who owns what? What right do they have to claim ownership over this land? But then you've got this other order over here, which is really the maritime rules-based order. And that's about entitlements of states to the use of the seas, to entitlements to maritime resources, and this is led primarily by UNCLOS, by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. So on the one hand, sovereignty is like the constitution of international society, but on the other hand, you've got UNCLOS, which is the constitution of the oceans, and they don't actually get along all the time. And states might try and make an issue about sovereignty in order to try to sideline the capacities of UNCLOS to negotiate contests around these resources. So I'm really interested in maritime order. How do we create maritime order when this is what we're looking at? Like, it's supremely complicated. Six claimant states, a whole bunch of regional non-claimant states. How do we create maritime order? And what I mean by that is the presence of relatively stable patterns of behaviour of states in oceanic affairs. I mean, the development, or the maintenance actually, of clear and coherent rules that govern the use of seas and maritime resources. And the third is effective mechanisms for maritime dispute resolution and conflict avoidance. So I'm interested in how these two orders interact in maritime disputes. Because it's clear to me that the South China Sea case study is really putting some stresses on the capacities to establish a normative order over the seas and the resources that these spaces provide. And particularly important in the South China Sea is whether or not this is actually a litmus test. This is what we don't really know, is whether or not this is like a testing ground for reordering the region. Certainly, the discourse out of the United States perceives the South China Sea disputes as a testing ground, that if China is able to get its way in this area, that it will try to do the same in other global common spaces. So I'm not entirely convinced that we have enough evidence about that, because it might just be the case that the South China Sea is a particularly unique area, and it certainly is in the strategic imagination of China. But it's clear that the United States sees this as a kind of front line for a changing order and challenges to the rules. So the maritime domain is shaping up as a key theatre of great power rivalry and normative contestation. So contest over key norms, disputes about rules, how they're interpreted, but also about the relationship between international and domestic law features quite significantly in this dispute. So the Indo-Pacific, I mean, we're kind of in the heart of the Indo-Pacific. Yeah, in Perth, are we not? I mean, the Western Australian politicians were quite significantly important in the adoption, the promotion of the Indo-Pacific construct that Australia has now adopted. Fair enough. I mean, we are surrounded by Indian Oceans, Pacific Oceans. We haven't put the Southern Ocean in the construct, title of the construct yet, but maybe one day. But, you know, this, we are at the centre of these two oceans. It's essentially a maritime construct. So we are aware that the maritime domain is a significant theatre. And in Japan and the United States, the free and open component, they call it FOIP, a bit awkward, but free and open Indo-Pacific. This free and open part emphasises maritime rules. It emphasises freedom of navigation and overflight. It emphasises liberal ideas of the seas as a global commons. So going back to those, you know, 400-year-old Grotian precepts of mare liberum, or freedom of the seas. This idea that the seas shouldn't be subject to sovereignty of one state is something that has underpinned international public law for centuries. And these are the things that in this particular dispute seem to be kind of coming under challenge. So understanding what states do, how they interpret maritime space and their authority over that space, and the extent to which they're willing to defend or abdicate in the maritime sphere is really important for considering the limits and possibilities for regional cooperation more generally. For example, there are many in DC, in Washington DC, who, as I said before, are willing to express freedom of navigation as a kind of vital US interest. And they present China's legal stance and activities, its grey zone activities, as a threat to this vital interest. But at the same time, the United States has not ratified UNCLOS, which is a bit of a problem. And so, some people will say to me, it doesn't matter on the ground. Like, everybody knows we follow UNCLOS. And it does. I mean, the United States follows UNCLOS as a sort of system of customary law. But at the same time, it has a political situation that has not allowed administrations, not that the Trump administration hasn't tried, but it has not permitted Democratic or Republican administrations to be able to pass this through Congress, to actually ratify the convention. Freedom of navigation might be a vital interest, but it doesn't, the message that's being sent out is ratifying UNCLOS might not be such a necessary or vital interest. But putting that aside for the moment, I want to park that. I'll come back to the issue of ratification later. But clearly, cooperation and partnerships are on the mind of US policymakers when it comes to the Indo-Pacific more broadly. So the Indo-Pacific Strategy Report released in June emphasised the importance of regional like-minded allies and partners. This is part of an ongoing narrative about the importance of like-minded states, of which obviously Australia is one. And there are sort of three key prongs to this narrative. The first, there is a clear attempt on behalf of the United States bureaucracy, maybe not always Trump himself, but others working on behalf of Washington, a clear attempt to reassure allies and partners about the US commitment in the region. I mean, these people, they know that there are people in the region who doubt the US commitment to allies, but also to maintaining a presence that can really kind of deter China from, trying to become a regional hegemon. So there's a clear attempt to reassure allies. But the second part is there's also an acknowledgement that alliances and partnerships give the United States a comparative advantage that other rising powers don't have, particularly China. So in contrast with rivals, this network of alliances and partnerships really bolsters US power, and it is important. The third thing, at the same time, though, there is an expectation that allies and partners need to step up, that there needs to be more in terms of burden sharing. And the former Defense Secretary, Jim Mattis, said, the US offers strategic partnerships, not strategic dependence. So there is an expectation that like-minded states will help preserve the maritime rules-based order that has been led by the United States. And of course, this concept of a like-minded state is not just used by the United States, it's used by Australia. I mean, the Australian 2017 Foreign Policy White Paper placed a lot of emphasis on the most important relationships in the region being with like-minded democratic states in the region. So what I kind of am really interested in is how like-minded are like-minded states? When it comes to a complex issue like this, how like-minded are they on how to defend the rules that are coming under challenge? And so I'll begin with, there's a broadly held concern among like-minded states that Beijing is attempting to revise certain international rules in its favour, and that the South China Sea is a key example of this intent. So broadly, there is this kind of agreement. But they don't necessarily agree on all aspects of what to do about it, or even where these disputes are located. I mean, this is an example of different maps that have been released by the Quad states, so the members of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, and they show different perspectives of where the Indo-Pacific is. So there doesn't, I mean, the Indo-Pacific is kind of at a nascent stage of development, really. But if we think geographically, these states conceptualise it in quite different ways. Australia and the United States see it as Asia-Pacific plus India, really. Harry Harris described it as from Hollywood to Bollywood. But, you know, India doesn't view it like that. India sees the western part of the Indian Ocean as being just as important in its conception of the Indo-Pacific. So we might talk about this in the discussion about whether or not that matters. But strategically, you know, US and Japan talk about, as I said before, in terms of free and open Indo-Pacific. But Australia doesn't really use that terminology, and India does not. India focuses more on inclusiveness. It doesn't want the Indo-Pacific to be conceptualized as a containment strategy against any one state, against China, let's face it. Whereas the US, particularly in the Indo-Pacific Strategic Report, has adopted a much more confrontational stance under the Trump administration. And of course, there are some like-minded states that are identified in the Australia's foreign policy white paper that are reluctant to take up the terminology at all. South Korea, for example, has been reluctant. New Zealand has been reluctant. So it gets to a general difference in how states perceive their relationship with China and how they seek to manage this changing global order. I was going to talk a bit about the Quad, but we might leave the Quad for... Okay, well, I was just going to say that actually the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue is one of the key initiatives kind of coming out of this Indo-Pacific concept. But even even given that these states are like-minded, the Quad has faced some challenges due to some sort of fundamental differences in strategic outlook and interests. So, for example, you know, the first iteration of the Quad in 2007 was kind of ended up not really working out because Australia, under the Rudd government, became hesitant because of Beijing's criticisms around the Quad. And so when I talk to officials, Indian officials, they'll often say that Australia's the problem with the Quad. But if you talk to officials from some of the other states, they'll say India's a problem with the Quad because they don't want it to be seen as a containment strategy for China. So you have these quite different positioning that in the end can impact on how successful something like the Quad is in terms of alliance building or partnerships or burden sharing and how effective these sorts of coalitions might be in trying to defend these rules that are coming under contestation. One example is Australia still has not been let into the Malabar exercises. So these are the other three states do these exercises. It seems clear to me that Australia would like to participate in them, but India has still been reluctant in really letting Australia back into the fold. So you've got some of these issues of lingering mistrust and uncertainty as well. Maybe mistrust isn't the right word, but just, you know, differences in strategic outlooks. So as I said, there are some broad shared interests. Emphasis is placed from the four states that I'm looking at, Australia, Japan, South Korea, and India, broad similarities in the importance on regional stability. So there are concerns about escalating tensions. There are concerns about the risk of military conflict, particularly between the great powers. Now, strategists like Brendan Taylor from the ANU would argue that the chances of a great power conflict in the South China Sea are slight, very low. And that's like largely, I think in my view, this is largely down to the fact that ultimately the United States just doesn't have the interest in the area. Like they might talk about freedom of navigation and vital interests, but, you know, if Scarborough Shoal was going to be taken off the Philippines or something was about to happen there, it's questionable about whether the United States would really want to get involved. It only has one ally in that particular dispute, and that's the Philippines. So if things go on with the Vietnamese, well, what responsibilities does the United States have to get involved to defend the rights or the entitlements of these small states? But nevertheless, there are concerns about regional stability. And geographically, I mean, the consequences of a conflict would actually be felt more by proximate territory. So Japan and South Korea would be more impacted immediately. And the worst case thinking from Japan in the conversations that I've had with officials from Japan is that the island building activities and the military, the naval militarization are giving or have already given China strategic control of the sea lines of communication within that crucial first island chain that goes down the Japanese archipelago down to the Philippines. And they're really concerned that this has enabled China to build a deep sea bastion to base nuclear attack submarines capable of launching missiles with nuclear warheads. So this is, from the Japanese perspective, this is, you know, really kind of bad news. But as I said, whether or not it's a flashpoint depends a lot on the US. We know that it's a core interest of China. Like, that much is clear. But is it a core interest of the United States? There's also concerns linked with regional stability about the two competing notions of freedom of the seas and control of the seas. So there's this kind of emergence of a binary narrative. China is seen to be wanting to control the seas, where the US positions itself as freeing the seas. But of course, as a great naval power, the United States has gained substantially from its own command of the seas. And I think we really need to separate the commercial and the military aspects of freedom of navigation, which I'll get back to in a minute. But nevertheless, these states do express an interest in freedom of navigation as a general principle. Of course, the other important stake for these states is the maintenance of international law, which doesn't always, like, we talk about the rules-based order, but it's actually, we're talking about a law-based order. We're talking about challenges to specific laws that are embedded within the international structure. And what I'd like to argue is that these rules and norms matter more to non-great powers, like Australia, because ultimately, lesser powers were less capable of unilaterally defending legal rights. Consider Australia. It has the world's third largest EEZ, but it is home to 1/3% of the world's population. The search and rescue zone of Australia over which we have international responsibilities, constitutes a tenth of the world's surface. Like, that is an immense amount of space. And there are obviously a lot of entitlements that come and responsibilities that come with that space. So how does a state like Australia defend the rules-based order that provides these vast entitlements, that are the basis of these vast entitlements? Now, Abhijit Singh, the commander from the Indian Navy and a very important thinking on India's naval strategy, writes that Indian policymakers are also acutely aware of the South China Sea as a test case for China, to see what China can get away with and what they might be able to extend into other maritime domains, particularly the Indian Ocean. So India has expressed this concern about, you know, what the South China Sea might mean for the Indian Ocean, which is obviously its primary concern. Yet at the same time, India is reluctant to meddle. It has its own interests in its own backyard, coupled with limited maritime capacity, which is a reality for smaller states, right? Middle powers, middle-sized powers, even regional powers like Japan, and smaller powers like New Zealand have to really think about where they're going to devote their resources into defending the maritime rules-based order. But the rules, I think, matter for non-great powers, but they also matter increasingly for the power and influence of the United States as it seeks to maintain its influence and partnerships in the region. But are the rules interpreted in the same ways? And what do they prioritise? So as I said before, I don't need to go on about this, but freedom of navigation really is at the heart of the US perspective of its interests in the South China Sea. But let's look at what let's look at how they perceive freedom of navigation. So it's clear from this table that there's actually a number of deviations from important like-minded states on the nature of freedom of navigation. South Korea, for example, requires a 3-day notification for foreign warships or non-commercial government vessels in its territorial waters. So it wants, say, warships, foreign warships, to let Seoul know that they're coming before they do. India requires prior notification of warships as well as foreign vessels carrying particular or certain types of cargo. And in the past, India has officially protested against US intelligence gathering and surveys conducted in its EEZ. So this is something that the United States sees that it's able to do under international law. India says that it does not have that right to conduct those activities. So actually, its conception of military freedom of navigation is closer to Beijing's than it is to the United States. And part of the issue is that UNCLOS is vague on the types of military activities that might be conducted in EEZs without coastal state consent. And this ambiguity creates space for contests around the territorial and maritime order that I was talking about before. So that is, there's a contest between these states who wish to be able to sail, fly, and operate in the broadest possible space and those that seek greater sovereign control over that space because, you know, in the Indian Ocean, India doesn't necessarily want Chinese subs trawling around. So there's these kind of different perspectives that emerge depending, I think, on, you know, the size of the state but also the size of the navy. And the interests that these states are trying to protect. So, I mean, one of the questions I would ask, and maybe somebody's got a good answer for me in the discussion, but why is it that a state like Australia supports the US interpretation of FON? And why does China not support that interpretation of FON? Now, I think I've got a pretty good reason. Part of it is wrapped up in Australia's alliance with the United States. But when you think about it, Australia has this vast entitlement. Maybe it doesn't want naval warships from foreign countries trawling around and doing intelligence gathering and other sorts of surveys and other sorts of activities. So I think it's kind of an interesting question to pose about whether or not this interpretation of freedom of navigation is one that necessarily suits Australia's defence interests. And China's just inconsistent on this point. I mean, it doesn't want the United States doing freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea, but it will happily conduct similar operations off the coast of Alaska or off the coast of Guam or in the British Channel. And it argues that in the South China Sea, it's protected by its domestic laws, that its domestic laws determine how that space is utilised. Now, that kind of pushes international law out of the picture. But then, you know, some of what the United States does in terms of its exceptionalism has also in the past on a number of issues meant that it hasn't ratified important points of international law because of its domestic law. So arguably, and I don't want to stress the point too far, but just point out that some of what's going on here in the South China Sea is exceptionalism with Chinese characteristics, which is controversial, I know. And I don't mean that there's an equal sort of equivalence between what the United States does and what China does. But you know, the United States does have a history not ratifying particular forms of international law. So it's an interesting way of thinking about it, I think. But there are time, there might become a time when China aligns its view with the United States, because actually the United States' view of freedom of navigation suits a big naval power, and that's what China wants to become, or is already a great naval power. So again, you come back to this kind of difference between, you know, what a big state can do and a big navy can do compared to what smaller states and what smaller navies can do. So Japan is interesting because the South China Sea is seen partly through the lens of the East China Sea, and Japan is particularly sensitive concerning the Senkaku Islands. So it has a dispute with China over the Senkaku Islands, and Japan sort of protests when China does innocent passage transit within 12 nautical miles of Senkaku. And what they argue is that because there's a dispute, China is prejudicing good faith or is, you know, sort of destabilizing things by conducting those particular transits. So Japan is very sensitive to official Chinese vessels going anywhere near the Senkakus. So for Australia on freedom of navigation, the big issue that comes up is to phone up or not to phone up. How do you defend military freedom of navigation? And freedom of navigation is often presented as a litmus test for a state's commitment to freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. India and South Korea have been quite vague and presented somewhat qualified and muted positions on phone-ups, given that they have a different interpretation of what this means. And they tend to offer support for FON, freedom of navigation, rather than for freedom of navigation operations. And again, referencing Commander Singh here, he argues that India doesn't agree with phone-ops as it doesn't want to provoke China or end up on the wrong side of a regional hegemon. India's concern with military FON is that it could open up, as I said before, the prospects of China increasing its presence within the Indian Ocean. And despite being strongly aligned with the US in security, Japan and Australia are also risk-averse when it comes to conducting these styles of operations. We tend to talk about FONOPS in this country as transit. It's like an innocent passage transit within 12 nautical miles of land features claimed by China. But actually, as we can see, this is again helpfully provided by ANTI, is that there are all sorts of different FONOPS that the United States engages in to challenge different types of excessive maritime claims. And so the question is, you know, is it, do we really have an understanding, a strong understanding in this country of what phonops are, what they're about, what their purpose is? Because actually in the US, they are a diplomatic and legal tool, and the operational component is the third stage, or it should be the third stage. So I think having an understanding of what these sorts of operations are supposed to do or provide would probably be a good thing in terms of the debate in Australia, which tends to be quite narrowly focused on one type of freedom of navigation operation. So why the reluctance with Australia? I mean, Australia has not been shy in its public diplomacy about the need for China to play by the rules and to adhere to the 2016 Arbitral Tribunal ruling. Yet operationally, the not doing the phonops has kind of seemed to make it appear timid on the issue. But for Australia, the problem is, one, are they effective? Do you risk, you know, your naval forces and personnel? Do you take them out of doing something else that might be better for partnerships or for public diplomacy or, you know, for increasing engagement in the region? What risks might these phonops actually present to destabilizing the region? Australia's focus, the Royal Australian Navy focus is on, at least my interpretation, is on routinization. So it's about business as usual. It is about playing by the rules. And every time the Royal Australian Navy sends a warship out into the waters, it is consolidating or supporting the rules of the road. And so it's about trying to maintain these practices that underpin maritime order, rather than doing actions that are going to be provocative and potentially destabilizing. And of course, the other factor for Australia and the phone-op question is how much is this going to provoke Beijing and what kind of economic costs might that entail? Because it's not simply a case of Canberra being able to just do what it wants. It needs to think about these very important trade relationships with Beijing. So commercial freedom of navigation, a popular assertion is made that conceding control of the South China Sea to China would imperil free trade. Of course, any potential blockade by China would be consequential to all regional states, particularly the ones in this study. And I'll take Australia. Purportedly, 2/3 of its trade passes through the South China Sea. This one's a bit tricky, actually, because while that's what the Defence White Paper of 2016 says, and it's often used, we have maritime experts like Sam Bateman, who argues that not only are those figures exaggerated, but that most of the trade is coming to and from China anyway. So why are they going to blockade their own trade? So, I mean, as a peacetime issue, is commercial freedom of navigation really a problem for Australia? Why would China threaten its own trade? So there just tends to be a bit of an assertion that goes unexamined around the importance of commercial freedom of navigation in this particular instance. And if it is about economic security, then, you know, the bigger issue might be how pushback in the South China Sea will affect trade relations. So if, you know, Australia's thinking about its economic interests, perhaps it is, you know, it's better not to provoke Beijing in the pursuit of doing things to secure or to enhance commercial freedom of navigation. So my view on this, and feel free to challenge me if you like in the discussion, is that the South China Sea is not really about economic interests for Australia, but it provides a rationale. It's particularly for domestic audiences as to why these regional states should be considered stakeholders in this particular area, which is not to say that I don't think that commercial freedom of navigation isn't really important for Australia, because it is. Something like 98% of our trade goes by sea. It's incredibly important. The question is, what are the threats to commercial freedom of navigation that Australia faces in the South China Sea? Are they credible threats? And I'm still working my way through that question, but we might be able to discuss that later. But I argue, actually, that what really matters is the rules. So that third point that I said, that the rules really matter for Australia. And a key critical juncture in the South China Sea was the arbitral tribunal ruling in 2016 between the Philippines and China. And there were three key findings here. The first, that its claims to historic rights within the Nine Dash Line were illegal. Second, none of these features subject to arbitration, including the Spratlys, could be legally classified as islands, although some were classified as rocks entitled to a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. Therefore, none of the features have entitlements to an EEZ or continental shelf claim, which actually is quite helpful because it strips back some of the confusing layers that I talked about in the first slide. So there is a potential here to set a new legal standard, quite a high legal standard on what a rock is. Now, UNCLOS is quite vague on what a rock is, and so this ruling, it's final and binding on the parties to the dispute. It is not necessarily binding on any other party, but there is contest among international lawyers as to whether the tribunal went too far in defining or trying to come up with a definition of an island versus a rock. So the responses to this arbitration from the regional non-claimant states was actually quite mixed. So Australia, US, Japan, and New Zealand called for the ruling to be respected. India and South Korea noted the award but didn't call for compliance. There's quite a bit of diplomatic nuance in how the states responded to this ruling, because obviously China has rejected this ruling outright. It didn't recognise the legitimacy of the arbitral tribunal ruling, and it has done a lot of work to discredit the ruling in its public diplomacy. But what's really interesting, and I'm going to wrap this up soon, I'm not sure how much time I have left, but I'm going to wrap it up. What's really interesting is what constitutes rocks and islands, how this might potentially affect the EEZ claims of other states. So Australia, for example, claims an EEZ around Heard Island and McDonald Islands in the Southern Oceans. This would, you know, if we adopted the standard of the arbitral tribunal ruling, these would be classified as rocks, not islands. And so your 200 nautical mile EEZ would go. Australia has another problem, of course, in that it has this curious little, curious kind of claim to 2 million square kilometres off the coast of the Australian Antarctic Territory, which is not recognised by other states, given that its sovereign claim to Antarctic Territory is not formally recognised, because we have the existing treaty system. So, you know, such a ruling around rocks can have implications for Australia. It has implications for Japan. Okina Torishima claims the atoll is significant enough for it to claim an EEZ, which is driven by Japan's significant interest in fishing. Japan is the only embassy in Washington, D.C. that has a fishing attaché, who I met, lovely guy. But China and South Korea argue that it does not meet the definition under UNCLOS to be an island rather than a rock. We've got the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. India's use of outlying archipelagic baselines is not recognised by the United States. This is from the JAG Maritime Claims Resource Manual. This is a fascinating document that outlines all of the problems that the United States has with other states and their excessive maritime claims. Fantastic resource. Here we see India is sort of brought up as being problematic. And actually, the Chinese Society of International Law produced this massive article, 540-page article, the Chinese Journal of International Law that just completely tried to discredit the arbitral ruling. And one of the states that it targeted was India. So that's kind of interesting that they're using India's claim as a way of trying to justify some of its claims in the South China Sea. Both Japan and South Korea employ baselines not recognised by the United States. And, of course, the United States has its own issues under the arbitral tribunal ruling, its own EEZ over a collection of features in the Pacific is questionable if that becomes the dominant legal standing. So, of course, the 2016 arbitral tribunal ruling may not be the final word on how rocks are defined, but it does present some potential future issues in terms of how these like-minded rules preservationist states interpret the rules and how they defend and conceive their own interests within that legal framework. I think I had a couple more slides, but I think I might leave it there because I'm running out of time. So just in conclusion, I would like to say that I think it does matter that states have different interests, visions of order, and conceptions of the rules. And it's particularly because China in the South China Sea is deploying what is called a lawfare strategy, you know, using ambit claims, using confusing narratives, using different types of sort of alternative conceptions of the law to justify and to persuade others in the region that their claims in the South China Sea are valid. I mentioned before, one of the narratives that they use is the hegemony of navigation. This is the idea that phonops, US-style phonops, and its obsession with freedom of navigation is a form of hegemony of navigation, that the US is imposing its will on the region. That's one narrative. The other narrative is that UNCLOS is not Asian, that the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea does not have, you know, it doesn't reflect Asian values, which, of course, is a really problematic argument given that China was at the table when UNCLOS was negotiated and finalised in 1982. And, in fact, that international legal document, the fact that we have EEZs at all, is partly responsible for the negotiators that came from developing states in Asia. Tommy Koh from Singapore is a great example of this. And he does a lot of work countering this idea that UNCLOS is just this Western legal order. And in fact, it's a legal order that smaller states have had a big part to play in it. And I think that's really important. So coherence and legitimacy in international practices can matter when we're talking about these contests in narrative, when we're talking about the ways in which great powers and regional powers are trying to influence states in the region, particularly the Southeast Asian states who are notorious hedges. The arguments that get used are really important, I think, for understanding regional dynamics. So I'll leave it there, and I'm interested in your thoughts and comments and questions.
Thanks very much.
Well, we do have time for a few questions. Some observations. Well, we'll keep them relatively brief, but Beck's staying for dinner, so there's plenty of time there. So it's just a courtesy, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself as well, right up the front.
Thank you very much, Beck, for a very interesting talk. I was just wondering what your thoughts... Oh, sorry, Mark Briskey. I was interested in your thoughts on what you think the Belt and Road Initiative, especially in regards... We're looking at India and we saw that big line of trade there.
Yep.
It'd be interesting to see the arrows there. But especially the Belt and Road, that the Chinese investment in Gwadar, in the port in Pakistan, and some of their maritime investments in Sri Lanka, and this sort of, so this envelopment of India too, that they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is kind of at the heart of India's focus is the Indian Ocean. So when we talk about the Indo-Pacific, often these states are still really focusing on sub-regions as part of that Indo-Pacific. So it doesn't mean that the Indo-Pacific is problematic, it just means that it's an overlay of these different maritime domains. And in India, the focus is very much on the Indian Ocean. And as you point out, these maritime disputes and these decisions that have to be made about, you know, how to defend maritime rules, what to do with a limited navy, how to deploy these assets, are tied up with these other strategic concerns. And there's no doubt that in my conversations that Indian officials are concerned about the Belt and Road. And a few, I'm not sure how long ago, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, there was this concern about the string of pearls in the Indian Ocean, the string of military bases. And some people were like, that's exaggerated, but now it's back. It's definitely back as a concern because of what's going on in Sri Lanka and Pakistan. Now even in Cambodia, while it's a little bit further away, you've got these kind of concerns about what's going on in these strategic bases and these ports. And actually, Scott Swift, who was the commander of the 7th Fleet for a couple of, maybe 3 years, during the Obama administration, he described the South China Sea as the first step of the Belt and Road. So he actually sees the South China Sea as being, and that area, as being very much embedded in what's going on with the Belt and Road. And we look at, India, it's important for India, but if we look at the Philippines, if we look at how the Duterte administration has softened so much and has not sought to use the 2016 arbitral tribunal ruling in its favour, has instead sought to, in an economically pragmatic way, has sought joint development and has sought infrastructure funding as part of the Belt and Road Initiative. You can see how that is playing into how states are responding to the disputes.
And we've got another question here, and then Jim up there.
Max and Beatrice, in geopolitics. Very interesting, use the word hegemon. Hegemon means, in fact, a driver, but a manager of the people to follow. It's a very old term. It's one of the first terms of international relations way back 3,000 years ago. It looks to me, from what you just said, is that the hegemon is really China. The big ones, like the Philippines, are trying to see. They don't want, I believe, that I've read in the press that, in fact, the Southeast China, the Southeast Asian region, don't want American interfering literally in this area. They prefer to, in fact, fall down to the hegemon China. What is your opinion?
I've actually got an article coming out about this very issue, and what I find is that there are 10 ASEAN states, and they have actually very different approaches, and those approaches can be determined by a range of different factors, including things like domestic politics, regime, leadership. Philippines is a great example of how a state can change its policies just by changing its leaders as a result of domestic political factors. But generally, the Southeast Asian states, you've got some who are bandwagoning. So when we talk about bandwagoning, we mean these are states that are going to support the rising power. Cambodia, for example, is a good example. Myanmar is also a good example of states that are very close to the rising power. Then you've got a range, Thailand and the Philippines still have alliance arrangements with the United States. So it's not as if they are just falling into line either. But you've got other states, Singapore, for example, were very intent on not having to make a choice. This is what hedging is. Say, Indonesia does not want to make a choice on this. It doesn't want to have to. It doesn't want to have to directly balance like Australia does. It's complicated, but Australia, in my view, is a balancer with the United States and the rules-based order. But these states, they don't, and they, I think they will hold it up for as long as they can. But what that requires is the United States being present in the region, because you know, in times of great power competition, smaller states can leverage it. We see it in the Pacific. Those small Pacific Island states, and they're leveraging their position for as long as it lasts, I think. As long, you know, because it won't last forever. But these states have agency. Like, they're not just going to fall in line, I don't think. I don't think that it's as... structure matters, but so does the domestic and constraints of states, so does their agency. And so, you know, different states will take different approaches. It's not a good idea to conflate ASEAN either, because it's actually 10 different actors. And part of the problem with the South China Sea is none of them, they don't agree on how to deal with it. They've got a code of conduct that they're negotiating at the moment, which, you know, that they might get some progress on. But, you know, the continental states have a very different view from the maritime states. You know, the ones who are claimants have very different sets of interests. So I don't necessarily think that these Southeast Asian states are just going to fall in line with China. That's my view.
Now we've got time for two quick questions, Jim and then Anna, and then we'll have to wrap it up.
Okay. Jim Baxter, you talked about litmus test. As far as I can see, the 2016 Philippine issue was a litmus test. China chose to ignore it. All you're talking about is everybody playing by the rules. What confidence do you have that China will actually play by the rules?
Well, that's a really good question. And so it kind of gets back to this, well, interpretation, but more importantly, I think, is this question of whether the South China Sea is sui generis, whether it's unique. Whether, because it's framed in the China sort of strategic imagination as a near sea, you know, it's perceived as being a sort of, what do they call it? I think it was Harry Harris again, or maybe it was Phil Davis, I can't remember. The Great Wall of Sand. This is this idea that that they perceive this particular sea area as being like land area, that they actually have a continental approach to what is maritime area. And so that means, and they have a raft of domestic laws that they try to exert over that area. So the question, and I mean, I don't have a good answer for it, is whether or not, you know, China is doing something unique in the South China Sea, or whether or not it's just starting with the South China Sea. And it's going to move into the Indian Ocean, and maybe it's even going to move into the Arctic and Antarctic and space, other non-sovereign spaces. But this is the problem with risk, right? Like, you know, leaders of states have to deliberate on what the risk is. And I think that a lot of states see that this is just the beginning. And the problem is that if you let China get away with too much in this one area, they will take more in another area. And that's the great threat. So as I've said, I don't think it's just about, like, say, commercial freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. It's really about the rules that underpin the whole system. And if they come under attack by a great power refusing to recognise an important ruling like that, and that has consequences for all states, but particularly states of our size, because we rely on it.
And we've got Anna promised a quick question.
Anna,
thanks.
And Ms. Murdoch, you've just gone into that area of what happens if there's an event, I mean a military event or a mistake or an accident. So given that, and given where we are and our sense of where our security lies, why do we have only about 3 weeks' worth of oil, no refineries, or very few, and also it's not just about what we have and what we haven't got, it's also when there's any conflict, the insurers say those ships will not go down there anyway, so even if you can actually procure ships to bring things down, they're not going to move because of the insurance. It's a fantastic question. I mean, we are not meeting our International Energy Agency commitments when it comes to fuel. We're supposed to have 90 days, and we have, I think, a third of that. And actually, I was reading something today, and I can't verify how true this is, but somebody seems to believe that if it wasn't for the US standing up for us, that we might get kicked out of the IEA because of that. I'm not sure how true that is, but it was an interesting thing that I was reading about today. But, you know, there are a range of sort of... there's sort of a lack of political incentive, I think, to shore up those fuel reserves because of the expense that is involved.
But this is national security.
Absolutely. Like, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, there are people... I mean, I read 4 years of Hansard recently on issues to do with the South China Sea. And, oh, that was... So I'll never get those days back. But one of the things that kept coming up was where you had... particularly independents who would go to Senate estimates and who would go to the joint standing committees and question this issue, why do we not have these reserves? Because it is absolutely in Australia's strategic interest, I think. I mean, why are we a part of the maritime construct, the maritime security construct in the Straits of Hormuz at the moment? And partly that's to do with the fact that Australia has interests in fuel security, energy security. I think it's a really important strategic issue. It's one that sometimes comes up in the discourse, but often I don't think a lot of people realise what a vulnerability that is. But, you know, it seems like China have their own energy security vulnerabilities. I mean, they call it the Malacca dilemma. And part of the reason why China is interested in the South China Sea, not just for strategic purposes or because of sovereignty purposes, but because there's a belief that the South China Sea is the second Persian Gulf. Now, energy agencies don't think that's quite right. They think there's an exaggerated belief in the oil and gas reserves in the South China Sea. But nevertheless, it has been widely regarded as a driver for Chinese action. So it's not just Australia who's vulnerable. In fact, there are a number of states who are vulnerable on that front.
Well, you're a star, Beck. Thanks so much. I want to say a rock star. Rock star presenter. So
I do
very
love
much.
Karaoke, but, so...
I remember. Can I just ask Grania? Grania coordinates our events on the committee, and she'll offer a vote. Thanks.
So, Beck, thank you so much. It's wonderful to have a speaker of your calibre come to Western Australia to visit us and share your research on such a complex set of issues. Thank you so much, and it's a small token of our appreciation.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Thank you.